for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Turkey mourns dozens of people killed in the attack on an Istanbul airport as authorities arrest suspects with possible links to ISIS. Brexit backer and former London mayor Boris Johnson ends his bid to become Britain's next prime minister. And Colombia begins to demobilize FARC rebels after an historic peace agreement to end the 52-year insurgency. Here for the week's top international stories on the Friday News Roundup, Natan Gutman of Channel One Israeli News and The Forward, Kim Kataz of the BBC, and Matthew Lee of Associated Press. Throughout the hour, we will be taking your calls, questions, comments, 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And it's good to see all of you.
Good morning.
There are reports out today that Turkish officials think that the Istanbul airport attack was planned by leaders of ISIS. What do we know?
Well, we know that even though ISIS hasn't assumed responsibility for the attack so far, all the leads show that it is an ISIS attack. We know that the nationality of the three suicide bombers, one of them came from Russia, one was an Uzbek, and one was a Kyrgyz. There are reports that point to one of the leaders of ISIS, Ahmed Chitayev, as the person who masterminded this attack, a person known as One-Armed Ahmed, who is one of the most dominant ISIS forces from Chechen background. And the assumption is right now is that this is... It wasn't an ISIS-inspired attack, as the attacks we've seen here in the United States. It was actually planned and carried out by ISIS. They brought in the people from Syria with their explosive vests and the machine guns. They planned the attack. Mm-hmm. They know exactly how to penetrate the airport by first attacking the security guards outside with machine guns and then moving in to explode use their explosive vests. So definitely all the signs are that this is an ISIS attack, a well-planned ISIS attack.
Kim, what's the significance of the attackers being from Russia and former Russian states?
Well, the so-called Islamic State has long been recruiting members from mainly Muslim parts of the former Soviet Union. The Russian President Vladimir Putin put the number at about 5,000 to 7,000 even, so that's quite a high number. There are several layers to this story. Obviously, there's the impact on Turkey, disastrous for its economy, for its tourism industry, you know, an attack that really goes to the heart of what Turkey is trying to be in a region at the crossroads of the East and the West. This Atatürk airport in Istanbul is really where everybody meets and everybody puts their identity, religious or sectarian or ethnic, to the side. They all come together in that airport. I've been there myself. But what it also tells us is that wherever the Islamic State militants come from, they have declared war on countries like Turkey that are now realizing that their, let's say, malign neglect of the very porous border between Turkey and Syria has come back to haunt them. They saw initially, even if they never publicly said so, that the Islamic State was one way of weakening President Assad, Bashar al-Assad, with which President Erdogan had a good relationship before 2011. And in the end, he called for President Assad's departure. And there was a kind of a policy of closing, you know, turning a blind eye to what the Islamic State was and what the threat it represented, in the hope that that this would end up weakening President Assad. Unfortunately, it has come as now to come back and haunt Turkey itself.
And Matthew Lee, what do we know about the people that the Turks have now rounded up.
Right. Well, I think that there's maybe an element, as there often is in these cases, of kind of rounding up the usual suspects. It's been the experience, I think, not just in Turkey, but across Europe, when they do these roundups of 13, a couple dozen people, that most of them are eventually released, found not to have been particularly involved, even if they had some kind of loose connection. But I think the point that Kim was making is true. Istanbul, you know, the crossroads of Europe and the Middle East or Asia, it's hard not to see this as an extension of the attacks in Europe. Mm-hmm. Turkey has been hit before because of its proximate location to Syria and to all these people. And I think, this is really, I think, takes it up a step, because it is this intermingling of the cultures there. And the other thing is that I think that it's probably that there's a high possibility that these attackers might have transited this airport on their way in to Syria in the first place. Because as what Kim was making the point, the Turks, if not overtly encouraged, but they certainly did seem to turn a blind eye to the influx at the beginning of these foreign fighters.
And that's the question, whether, in fact, the Turks will now step up their offense on ISIS.
Well, clearly that's their plan. They were very late in the game of understanding that ISIS is a problem for them. Turkey was focused, obviously, on the PKK before. As we heard, they saw some advantages to having ISIS operate as another force in Syria. According to some reports, they even purchased oil from ISIS at a certain point. So, but all this changed once they decided to join the coalition and allow the United States to use its air force base in Incirlik to launch attacks on ISIS in the region. And after that, Turkey became a target of ISIS. And it was very slow in understanding that and in understanding the need to counter this attack. And this is basically what we're seeing now, both in crackdowns inside Turkey and in further attacks.
But there's also some speculation that this attack on Turkey came about because of a Turkish-Israeli accord.
There are those who claim that, but it seems kind of unlikely given the timing and the planning of this event. Just to remind, Israel and Turkey finally signed, after years and years of negotiation, this normalization agreement, which would basically mean that Israel pays compensation to the families of those killed in the attack 6 years ago against the Turkish flotilla. And in return, normalization ambassadors will be returned to Ankara and Tel Aviv. But this is something that happened this week, and the ISIS attack seems to be planned for weeks or months, and it doesn't seem that this would be something that would trigger it.
I think the question that no one has the answer to right now is how Turkey is going to handle the next step. They are going to want to be tougher on ISIS. They will probably ramp up their participation in the anti-Islamic State coalition. They're just making nice again with the Russians as well as their normalization pact with the Israelis. But what are the Turks really prepared to do when it comes to fighting the Islamic State? What is the public in Turkey prepared to support?
Exactly.
There wasn't a lot of support in the past. Will there be now support for ground troops, for more participation of the Turkish Air Force? This is what we're going to find out in the next few days and weeks.
And what about Turkey's relationship with Russia?
Well, exactly. If there was to be a cause other than just a planned attack, I think that it's more likely that it was the Turkish-Russian relationship or rapprochement rather than the Turkey-Israel rapprochement behind it. But I don't think that was the case, because that came, the Turkey-Russia rapprochement came as something of a surprise, whereas the Israel-Turkey rapprochement had been, as was said, years in the making. I think what's going to be very interesting is to see if the Turks finally, after having agreed more than a year ago to seal off this 98-kilometer border area in which ISIS fighters have been able to go back and forth. The Turks, whether that actually happens or not, because it has not happened, although there have been some improvements, but it has not happened, and the border is still very porous. And
so this is something, they can just slip back and forth.
Correct. And this is something that the Russians in particular have been really going after the Turks about.
Turkey actually has served as the main entrance point for foreign fighters joining the battle of ISIS in Syria, and actually joining any other force in Syria as well, thanks to these open borders and to the very lax security there. So that's why we've seen this established route of foreigners coming either from Europe or even from North America through Istanbul.
Natan Gutman, he's Washington correspondent for Channel One Israeli News and The Forward. When we come back, we'll be talking with Lionel Barber, editor of the Financial Times, about the fallout from Brexit. Stay with us.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And welcome back. Joining us now from London is Lionel Barber. He's an old, old friend of this program, one of the first journalists who joined our Friday News Roundup when it was first created. Lionel, welcome.
How lovely to hear your voice, Diane, and what a privilege to appear on the show.
Thank you. So you've had another wild weekend, the fallout from the Brexit vote. Talk about why Boris Johnson took himself out of the race to succeed David Cameron.
Well, he didn't have a plan. He was unprepared. He led the campaign to take us out, but didn't know what the next chapter was going to be. And this is a bit strange because he's a former journalist. I remember him in the Brussels days. Some people who know him, including myself, think that this was a bit of a... He thought he was in a student debate, and he won the debate. And then somebody said, well, actually, do you remember that, in Diane, that wonderful movie with Robert Redford, the candidate?
Of course.
And he wins, and at the end, the camera zooms in, and Robert Redford looks at and says, what do I do now?
Exactly.
Well, that was Boris Johnson yesterday.
Tell us about the other candidate, Michael. Is it Gove?
Gove.
Gove.
It's not Gove as in government. It's Gove.
Okay.
As in stove. He's a Scot. He comes from a modest upbringing, didn't know his father. It was a reforming education secretary, actually justice secretary, very impressive on prison reform. He's a liberal. He's a liberal whose main objection to the European Union was on constitutional grounds, saying that Britain should not be bending before European law. So I see him, but also I think that his problem has been that he says, I have no charisma, I have no intention of running for prime minister. That's what he said 2 years ago. And he was of the man who stabbed Boris Johnson in the back, having been his campaign manager, and then said he didn't think Boris was fit to be prime minister or to lead. So this has, there's a bit of the Marx Brothers, Ruritania, about Britain at the moment.
And Lionel, you know that Natan Gutman, Kim Katas, Matthew Lee are here in the studio. They will enter into the conversation as well. But before that, I wanted to ask you about Theresa May, who does seem to be gaining support.
She's a formidable lady, a little bit in the Margaret Thatcher mold. She keeps herself to herself. She's been Home Secretary. That is, in effect, what you'd say in Europe would be the Interior Ministry, sort of Department of Homeland Security, with a sort of law and order function, law and order. And most Home Secretaries don't last more than 2 or 3 years. They've also got the counterterrorism portfolio, but she's lasted more than five. But she was in the Remain campaign. She wasn't a Brexiter, which has enabled her to say, well, I've been loyal to David Cameron, but now she's come out. And I think a bit, it's very strange, Diane. You'd say Boris Johnson, if you really scratched him or woke him up at night, in the early hours of the morning, he would be a Remainer, but he campaigned for exit. Well, with Theresa May, if you woke her up at 3 o'clock in the morning, she'd probably be for exit, even though she campaigned for Remain. Anyway, the point, if you're not confused by now,
lever.
I am. This is what is so strange, yes, about this whole affair. But Theresa May has definitely got an early lead. She's seen as an early favourite. And maybe doesn't have the kind of charisma of Boris Johnson, the showbiz variety. But as she said yesterday in a rather telling sentence, these are serious times that require serious people.
Kim reminds Katas. You of other politicians in the United States, women who say, I'm here just to get the job done. I'm not about the showbiz, right? That's very much the type of thing that we hear from Hillary Clinton, the presumptive Democratic nominee. But it's interesting, the point that Lionel was just making, the contrast between what Boris Johnson really believed in, but what he campaigned for, and those who say that, Theresa May is actually a closet leaver, but campaigned to remain because she was loyal to the Prime Minister. And there are some who say that that's also the contrast between feigned nativism, the Boris Johnson style, who was all about the showmanship, and authentic nativism, because she does get criticised as Home Secretary for actually being very harsh on immigration. She has made some very harsh statements, including saying that you cannot have a cohesive society if you have immigration. So there is now an effort as well to, slightly rewrite her profile to present her as a moderate in this campaign.
I think clearly whoever it is who's chosen to lead the Tories in a couple of months, the main goal would be to negotiate these terms of divorce with the European Union. And I'm just interested in hearing Lionel's take on that. How would they be different? How would they negotiate this differently, whoever's chosen?
The way I look at this, and I should have said, by the way, Diane, that Boris just wanted to be Prime Minister. He just hadn't quite figured out how he was going to do it.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. This was a raw power play for all what he said in the campaign. But let's come back to the terms of divorce and what happens. The fact is, none of the Leave campaign has come forward with a plan for the terms of divorce, or indeed, even more important, what the new relationship they want between Britain and the European Union. So I would describe this as, who wants a soft Brexit, which is essentially saying, well, we want to have full access, or pretty near full access, to the single European market for our services industry, for business. And we hope, we know we'll have to take some freedom of movement, but maybe we can sort of do some kind of deal with the Europeans. And then there's a hard Brexit, which basically says, the two goals of access, full access to the single market and free movement of people is incompatible with our firm opposition to more immigration or freedom of movement. So, in fact, we want a full divorce and we're just going to operate according to World Trade Organization rules, which will mean facing some industrial tariffs, but we'll just have to then negotiate with the EU and do our best. We don't know what any of these candidates really want. Yeah. Theresa May was a little bit clearer, but that's the problem. Nobody has a clear plan.
And there is the question, Matthew Lee, of how quickly all this is going to get done.
Exactly, and I'm not sure that the prevailing mood in Europe, the continental Europe at the moment, is in favor or will allow a soft exit. They're pretty upset and angry. You know, we talk about showmanship and all this and Boris Johnson and his removing himself, taking himself out. And I just, this whole thing reminds me of one of the greatest showmen of all time, P.T. Barnum, who, you know, in his traveling road shows to get people moving through would post a sign saying, "This way to the great egress." And people would not realize what egress was, and they'd go out and find themselves on the street looking around saying, "What have I done now?" And I think that that is pretty much an accurate representation of how many people are feeling right now, particularly the leaders of the Leave movement.
You've got one of the many large questions posed at this point is how the financial center of Europe is going to shift. Other European countries are certainly considering this.
Well, Paris has put out the red carpet. You've got Dublin. They think they can take a share. Luxembourg, Amsterdam, even Warsaw. But actually, we need to take a bit of a chill pill here, because the fact is that the UK government is not going to see a new prime minister before September, I think, at the earliest, unless all the candidates suddenly drop out. And I wouldn't exclude anything at this stage, but it's unlikely. And then, of course, you have to have some idea of what you want. You need to come forward with a plan. And only then do you invoke the so-called Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, which in effect then sets the clock ticking on a two-year negotiation period for divorce. And then after that, according to the Europeans, you start negotiating your trade agreement with the EU, etc. Now, that means that things are going to take quite a long time. And I spoke to a very senior official today, and he made the correct observation that people are not going to, very unlikely to just jump now or abandon all their operations in the city. They're going to take a little bit of time. And the other point, I guess, is that, yes, I mean, the crucial point is that we risk losing, for example, the euro clearing business. We risk losing the bank's passporting arrangements where they can easily operate throughout the European Union. But there will be other opportunities, and these sharp-minded people in the City of London are still looking at that right now, like, okay, we lose euro, but maybe we can get the RMB. So it's important not, I know all our listeners in New York, your listeners will be saying, rubbing their hands and saying, right, the business is coming New York's way, but I wouldn't write off the city just yet.
I think there's always opportunity in crisis. I think what's happened over the last week in the UK has been, you know, heartbreaking for those who voted to remain. It has been a surprise for some who voted leave. They didn't expect these consequences. But, you know, speaking to British friends who voted either way, there is also an understanding that now it's time to figure out how do we make the most of this.
Exactly.
I think the biggest clash remains, and I don't think we've heard a clear answer yet, is how does the UK negotiate the schedule of what happens with the EU? Because the EU is saying you exit first and do it quickly, and then we'll negotiate the settlement. You know, but we want the divorce first. And, you know, people like Theresa May are saying, you know, we're going to take our time. We're not going to rush into this. You know, we will have our leadership contests, etc. And then we will exit when we're ready and we'll renegotiate the terms.
It's interesting, though, that you mentioned the UK. I'm not sure that that's an appropriate acronym anymore or will be. It's interesting that we're talking about this on the anniversary of the return of Hong Kong to China from the Britain. But, one result of this may very well be that England really becomes England.
Any possibility in your mind, Lionel, that this whole thing will be re-voted?
Again, I wouldn't exclude everything, but even though there are more than 3 million signatures on a petition to have a second referendum, I think that there's, 20% chance, 15%. It is possible once you've invoked Article 50, people say it's irrevocable. There are some get-out clauses, but it's going to be very difficult. And the fact is that Theresa May has made it very clear that Brexit means Brexit. And I think it's very, very unwise at this stage for anybody to start talking about a second referendum. The fact is the people voted. They voted narrowly. It's amazing that we had a referendum that never had a ceiling, say, if you had to get to 70%. It was just any vote above 50%. And suddenly the most important decision for our economic and foreign policy is taken, and that's it. So I would say, Diane, I think it's highly unlikely.
All right.
We're moving out.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We have an email from Gary Lionel, who says, if there are important differences between Theresa May and Michael Gove on immigration, if the EU insists on the free movement of EU people for a trade agreement, would they both agree or refuse?
No, I think they will and would refuse because one of the reasons Michael Gove said he was abandoning or stabbing in the back, it's actually the same thing, abandoning the Boris Johnson campaign was because he didn't trust Boris Johnson on freedom of movement and immigration. And Theresa May has been a real hardliner on immigration. And I think on that, they won't. They know that they're going to have something short of full access to the single market. And the question is, what kind of trade deal, what kind of access we will have, and for which sectors?
And, Natan, we've seen the global movement sort of go up and down all through this past week. Do you think they're now settling into a new reality?
I think so, at least in terms of the financial markets. We've seen in the United States a rebound. Of course, it was the initial shock that sent all the markets plunging. But after that, it seems that there is a realization that, first of all, as we just heard, it will take a long time until this process is completed, and no one really knows right now what shape it will take at the end of this process. And therefore, there is some confidence coming back into the markets, at least in the United States. Of course, for the British economy, it will be more difficult, and it will be a long-term challenge to deal with. There's talk about a loss of 2% of the GDP in the long term. So definitely, that is something that will take time. But the world itself is starting to realize what had happened despite this initial shock.
And in the few seconds we have left, Lionel, what's your outlook for the British economy?
I think it's very difficult, given what the governor of the Bank of England said yesterday when he talked about post-economic traumatic stress that's already affecting. We've had a chill earlier with the uncertainty about the result. We've now got even more uncertainty. There is a big risk about investment, foreign investment, kind of drying up or at least on hold. You're going to see consumer behavior, spending affected. So it's hard not to think that there could be a setback, a recession, technical recession in the UK for the next two quarters.
All right.
And the governor and low interest rates.
So it's
hard stuff.
Lionel Barber, always good to hear your voice. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you, Diane.
Lionel Barber is editor of the Financial Times. Short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Before we move on to Iraq and Fallujah, let's take a call from Roshan in Houston, Texas. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. Love the show, by the way. Long-time listener.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Just a question on the attack in Ataturk Airport. Is there any consideration that the Russians might be involved, considering that ISIS didn't jump on the opportunity to take responsibility, as well as the Turkish army shooting down the fighter jet?
What do you think, Matthew?
I think that that's unlikely because, as we discussed earlier, there is this rapprochement now between the Russians and the Turks. President Putin has lifted the travel ban on Russians for Turkey, which is a boost for Turkey's ailing tourism industry. And so I don't think so. They seem to have agreed to let the plane incident be a bygone.
What about questions about the U.S. and Russia relationship? There was some news this morning of messages going back and forth.
Well, this idea of closer cooperation in the Syrian theater between the United States and Russia is not a new thing. In fact, the Americans have been, the U.S. has been pushing it for a long time, as have the Russians. Of course, they're on vastly different pages.
Exactly.
In terms of what that cooperation might take place. But, I mean, this idea that we've heard about this week was actually floated originally in Vienna at the last meeting of the International Syria Support Group. So it's not particularly new. What would be interesting is if something actually came of it. And I don't think that that is at all a foregone conclusion.
Because there wasn't any clear indication which sites Russia would continue to bomb.
Right. Well, in particular, the issue has been that groups that the Americans, that the U.S. considers to be moderate and have supported, have intermingled themselves with groups that even the U.S. believes are terrorist organizations, like al-Nusra. And de-mingling them has been a priority that's become even more of a priority as the Russians continue to go after al-Nusra and what they say are just hardcore terrorists.
Kim. One of the key questions here is, you know, as Matt says, will it actually happen, the sort of closer cooperation? And is it more than deconflicting? Because obviously the Russians and the Americans are operating in the same areas of the same territory. And a lot of the conversations have been about making sure they, in essence, don't crash into each other. But is it going to be more than just that? And that raises a lot of concerns amongst the Syrian opposition and those countries and political leaders in the region that are still opposed to Assad. Are we going to see the U.S. and Russia, join hands to fight ISIS and forget about Assad or not? But all of this has been rumbling for some time, and we haven't seen things go in that direction just yet.
Nadan.
Of course, there's a difference in the end game that the U.S. And Russia see for Syria, and Russia still believes that its military involvement there can, in a way, sustain the Assad regime either over all of Syria or parts of Syria. But the fact that the U.S. has gradually basically walked back its initial position that Assad has to leave. Now, by American standards, he doesn't have to leave immediately. He can be part of the solution in a certain way. The fact that this position has moderated in time does allow some kind of cooperation between the Russians and the Americans if they can agree on the targets on the ground.
All right. To Brian in Baltimore, Maryland. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. I wanted to know if there was any option for a future election for prime minister where maybe a liberal Democrat could run on the ticket that, you know, we cancel the Brexit.
Well, you know, it's not as if you run for prime minister in a national election. I mean, the prime minister is essentially the leader of the party. I don't think that unless the unless the Liberal Democrats stage some kind of a comeback, it's very unlikely that their leader is going to be the prime minister.
You know, both parties, both leading parties, the Labour Party and the Tories, are in a leadership crisis. And I think until we know who's, you know, what is going to emerge from both those crises, it's hard to make any predictions. And I think, as we've seen over the last week following the referendum, every hour brings new developments.
Exactly.
And every minute feels like a decade. So who knows?
To Denise in Tampa, Florida, you're on the air.
Thank you, Ms. Ream. Today is 100 years since the 1st of July, 1916, the first day of the Battle of the Somme, when I think it lasted from July through to November. More than 20,000 died on that first day. Most were from 36th Ulster Division from the north of Ireland. And, of course, those people did not have to go. They were trying to take something on a slope, didn't get any reinforcements, which they had requested. So it's very important to remember the sacrifice. And there is a plaque on a wall in their city of Belfast. Pass not this spot in sorrow, but with pride, and may you live as nobly as they died. And the people who came from what is now the Republic of Ireland, their sacrifice was ignored for all those years until about 20 years ago, when Mary Robinson, the president, finally went to the war graves in Europe. But they took part as well, and we have to acknowledge that from all of Ireland. Thank you very much.
I'm so glad you called. And again, it reminds us of the devastation of these conflicts. And we're speaking, she spoke about the 100th anniversary of that battle, and now we're talking about taking Fallujah back from ISIS, Natan.
Yeah, definitely. It's probably the most significant achievement that the Iraqi army has had so far, winning back Fallujah from ISIS after months of battling there. And what we've been seeing in recent days is not only the successful, in a way, takeover of the city, but also the fact that the Iraqi forces, aided by the Americans, were able to take out many ISIS fighters fleeing the city. And they view that as a significant blow to ISIS by the fact that it means that they're gradually shrinking the foothold of ISIS on the territory and actually managing to push the group into a more defensive position.
But, you know, reflecting on that 100-year anniversary, it's as though the world never tires of war. It just goes on.
And it goes on everywhere. It's not just in the Middle East.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, wars in Europe weren't that long ago. And, you know, it gives you comfort in the sense that you think, okay, well, wars do end at some point. So when you look at the Middle East today, you think there is hope. And what we saw with Fallujah is a tiny sliver of hope, the retaking of that city from the so-called Islamic State, which took over Fallujah 2 years ago. That was the first city to fall into their hands. It was, you know, the hub of their operations. They had hundreds, if not thousands, of fighters based there. And it rattled the Iraqis. It rattled the Iraqi national cohesion. It rattled the United States, which had invested so much in trying to build an Iraqi army. And so what we've seen now is just the potential beginning of the Iraqi armed forces feeling like they have a stake in this and they can come together to push back against the Islamic State.
But and they want to take Mosul next.
Exactly. But I think that what we need to remember and not forget is the role of the Iranian-backed militias in all of this, because as it is a success for the Iraqi army and for the Americans, but it is also a success for Iran, which was also very rattled by the fall of Fallujah. And I think that the rise of Iran, even more than it has in terms of influence in Iraq, is a key point that should not be overlooked. And on the anniversary of the Battle of the Somme, you know, this just reminds the school I went to in Scotland and the chapel and back in the 1980s, every single leaver, virtually every single boy that left that school between 1914 and 1916 died, and their names are on plaques on the chapel wall. And it's just stunning. It's the absolute devastation of the First World War and conflict since. It's incredible.
And as I said, we continue with war in all kinds of places.
Just one last point to pick up on what Matt was saying. It is absolutely key to remember Iran's role in Iraq and the role of the Shiite militias, which have been sometimes as brutal, if not more brutal, than the Islamic State. But what we saw with the Iraqi Armed Forces operation to take over, to retake Fallujah, is that the so-called popular mobilization forces, those Shia militias, were not at the forefront, were not the public face of this retaking. And that is important as well. Optics are important,
Indeed. If
they remain in the background.
And also, if we're thinking of the next step, there's all this talk now of after Fallujah going to Mosul. But that will be quite different, first of all, because of the magnitude, because of the size. Mosul is 10 times bigger than Fallujah. But also, it has a potential of bringing into conflict all these different forces that are fighting there, whether it's the Iraqis and the Shiites, the Iranian-backed, and the Kurds. All these fighting together in a major battle, and then having to deal with the outcome of driving ISIS out and dividing power and influence, that could have the potential for further tension.
All right, to Kathleen in Athens, Ohio. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I followed what Hillary Mann Leverett and Flint Leverett wrote and said for about the last 10 years. But after they're Middle East experts, I know you guys know who they are, but they had written 5 or 6 years ago that the Obama administration, the Obama-Clinton administration, with her as Secretary of State then, should take the power-sharing deal that Assad was allegedly offering 5 or 6 years ago. And so hundreds of thousands of dead later and millions of refugees, what would a power-sharing deal with Assad look like now?
Kim.
Well, the problem that the Syrian opposition had at the time and the backers of the opposition in the West had with whatever President Assad was offering was that they thought he couldn't be trusted, and that whatever he was offering was just, you know, a ploy. He did several times offer reforms and then didn't actually implement them. A lot of opposition leaders were jailed, imprisoned, tortured. But it is true that if the end result today is going to be a fig leaf type of power sharing arrangement with President Assad, a lot of Syrians are going to ask themselves, what did we all die for?
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's turn finally to what's happening in Colombia. Matt, the Colombian government started the process of disarming FARC rebels after last week's historic peace deal. Mm-hmm. What's in the deal?
Well, what's in the deal is just what you've said, the end of 52 years of the longest-running civil war in the Western Hemisphere. This is a huge deal. It's not getting as much attention as perhaps it should be, given the events of in other parts of the world.
That's why doing it here.
Right. But it's very significant. This has been going on, this insurgency, for 5 decades. And now, finally, if everything holds up and the demobilization continues apace, Colombia, vast parts of Colombia are going to see peace. And, this is a success for both Colombia, Cuba, and to a much smaller extent, the United States.
How difficult will it be to maintain this peace they want to achieve?
That's always the issue when you get a peace deal.
Kim.
We have to remember also popular sentiment in Colombia and what kind of justice will come out of this victims of the the war of the rebels will want to see some kind of justice as well. They may not be satisfied with the tribunals that will be set up. But just to go back to Brexit, actually, and the reason why the popular mood matters, when a final peace deal is signed, it will be put to a referendum. In Colombia as well. So, the popular say is important, and the president of Colombia will have to do a lot of work to sell the deal. Most people seem to be in favor of it, but it's a slim margin.
Natan.
Also, it's difficult to draw parallels between Colombia and other areas in the world, but I'm pretty sure that for many people in the Middle East, this is an interesting development to watch, because you get used to this concept that conflicts are impossible to reconcile, that terrorists have blood on their hands. And here we see a very long process, but that does offer some kind of hope for disarming, for a certain amount of justice, and for a transition to a political movement, which could just provide just a little bit of hope for people looking at the Middle East.
Yeah, I could not agree more. I mean, I'm from Beirut. I grew up in a war there. Wars do end in the end, but there's still a lot of conflict and violence around us in the Middle East. And there are times when we wonder, does it ever end? And then I have a friend who said, well, for the longest time, those of us living in Europe thought the Berlin Wall would never fall. And in the end, one day it did. And now we have this, peace deal with the FARC rebels in Colombia. And as Natan said, it's hard to draw parallels between regions in the world. But it does mean that, at some point, conflicts hopefully do end.
Well, not to be a spoiler
the downer.
Here, but yes, exactly. But, I think of the last major civil war that ended in Sudan. The creation of a new country, South Sudan, and what a disaster that has become. So let's just hope that the light at the end of the tunnel in the Colombia conflict isn't a locomotive bearing down to shatter the whole thing. Again, not to
We want it to end on an optimistic note, Max.
Absolutely. On this weekend before Independence Day, I wish you all peace and health. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Natan Goodman, Kim Katas, and Matthew Lee, thanks all for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Alexandra Boti, Susan Casey, Danielle Knight, and Allison Brody. The engineer is Alex Drewinskis. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, and podcasts. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. And we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.